Well, we got more time than I thought we would have to finish the book of Esther, and I'm really, really thankful for that. I don't know how long it's ever been since you've been in a study of the book of Esther. If you're a man, I would think it's been 50 years since you've been in a class on studying the book of Esther. It's just not a book that women study it, because there's all kinds of lessons in that book for women, and oftentimes at ladies' days and everything, they'll just take the book of Esther and make a full lesson out of it, and that's important. We do not have slides tonight, and so we'll just have to listen, but I want us to take up with where we ended the class last week, and that is we're at the point in Jewish history where the Jews are in unbelievable peril because of a man by the name of Haman. As you look in the book of Esther, there's something you will find out about Haman, about his how he is described, about the nationality he was from, and I'll let you find that. We'll look at it together tonight, but if you want to look for the first time Haman is introduced, there's something rather interesting about him. But he hates the Jews so much because, especially, there's one man by the name of Mordecai. Haman has been honored by the king of Persia. Ahasuerus is his name. Has been honored so much that he is in the place of prominence. And being in that place of prominence, he has elevated and gotten an ego problem like you would not believe. He just thinks he's the greatest thing on this earth. I think he is the original Muhammad Ali. If you know the way to describe him, you know, I am the greatest. You know, what did he say? Fight like a something and dance like a butterfly, or I can't remember. Sting like a bee, wasn't it, or something like that. And Haman, Haman is a very loving person, one of the most loving people you'd ever find in all of the Bible. He loves himself. He is not concerned about anybody else on this earth. And so he is the reason for all of the turmoil there is in the book of Esther. This book might not have even been written, but if there's any book in the Bible that shows God in the background working things out, one thing after another after another. I mean, you think about how Esther became queen. You stop and think about the whole circumstances of that. Here is king, and the name of that queen was Vashti, and she refused to present her beauty before drunken men at a feast. Now, that feast was not just an overnight feast. It's a feast that had gone on for 6 months. I want you to understand how long that, how drunk you can get in 6 months. I don't know if that's a good way to say it or not, but she said, I'm not going to do that. That's not who I am. That's not what I am. And the king is in turmoil because the men, his advisors from 127 political provinces, have instructed him, if the word gets out that the queen is not going to obey the king, every family in the 127 province is in trouble because there's going to be a wise rebellion, that's going to sweep this nation. And so he deposes the queen and gets rid of her. Well, what are you going to do for the next queen? And so they look in the 127 provinces and they find the beautiful women from those 127 provinces. And one is to be selected to be the next queen. How long does that process take? Well, it takes at least a year if you'll read it carefully. And finally, there is a Jewish young lady by the name of Esther. And she wins the favor of the king and is made to be the queen. And so you've got her being made queen, but she's been raised not by her mama and her daddy, but by her cousin Mordecai. And Mordecai becomes the focal point of the anger of Haman. Because you see, he is so honored by the king that everybody that sees Haman, whenever he goes anywhere, in the palace city called Shushan, they all bow down before him. But there's one man that will not bow down before him, and that's Mordecai. You ever have something get under your skin and it just irritates you so much you can't turn it loose? Well, Haman does, because Haman loves Haman, and Haman's been mistreated because of all of anybody on this earth. He is worthy. Just ask the king. He is so filled with his ego, and we'll talk about this later tonight, that when he's asked to come to the banquet that the queen of the world is giving, there's only two people at that dinner, at that feast, and one is the king and the other is Haman. And he says, I deserve that. I mean, his response and his not knowing what's happening in the background just shows what happens when a person gets so much in love with themselves, they can't see anything. But whenever Haman marches out, there's Mordecai, and he's at the king's palace. He's outside the gate of the palace, Mordecai is, and so whenever he leaves the king's palace, you know, dressed in all of the riches that his money would buy for him and all of the nobility and that he has and everything, Mordecai won't bow down, and it just gets under his skin, and every time he goes in and out, and he becomes almost as powerful as the king himself. The king loves him so much that whenever Haman makes a donation of 10,000 pieces of silver, I want you to hear that number, that the king gives his signet ring to Haman to write anything he wants to. Now, what he wants to write is to get rid of the Jews. Why does he want to get rid of the Jews? Well, he might have hated other Jews, but there's one guy he really, really hates, and that is Mordecai. Well, Mordecai, trying to figure out what's going on in the palace, in that year, evidently during that year, before Vashti is selected, pardon, not Vashti, but before Esther is selected, that he's outside in the courtyard of the king, and this may have happened after that, because the edict that he writes out, by the way, is in the third year of the king's reign. But he's just out there. That's his life. His life is wrapped up in his cousin. And is she going to become queen or not? Or maybe after she becomes queen, he just wants to be there for her. He overhears a plot from two of the king's servant eunuchs, and they're planning to kill the king. And so now we've got all of these things, pieces, got to put them all together now. And so that's where we are, is trying to put all of this together. And last week we were in chapter 4, and in chapter 4, there is that decree that goes out that says on a particular day, and they've selected that day by casting lots. And how you cast lots would perhaps vary from culture to culture. We sometimes cast lots by saying, pick a number between 1 and 10. You know, that's just trying to, you know, sometimes I think about when I pick a number between such and such. Brother W. Claude Hall at Freed Hardeman, who was a great fixture at the college, an anciently old man of 70 years of age when I was a student there. And his class was when everybody took. And he asked a student in his class, said, there were 10 questions, how many did you get right? And the student said, Brother Hall said it was between 4 and 6. He said, why didn't you just say it was 5? I love that. That's Brother Hall, the way you handle that. But that's sort of like casting lots. Now then, reading tea leaves is like casting lots. People will... We'll figure that. Now then, there's the matter sometimes trying to the equivalent of rolling dice or something of that nature. It was just in some way they cast lots for the garments of Jesus at the cross, and so you had to draw straws. I don't know how they cast lots, but one way or another, and they picked out that the time for the Jews to be killed was in the 12th month. And they picked that, they selected that month because when they cast lots, that's the month that came up. Could have been any of those months, but it was going to be in the 12th month. So we got a year, nearly a year ahead to make all of this happen and for the Jews to get ready. But the edict goes out that in the 12th month, on a particular day of the 12th month, every Jew could be killed and you could take their property. That's like hunting season. I think we used that expression last week. You know, if somebody's got something better than you have and you want to get it, well, just wait till the 12th month and kill them, and whatever they own will be yours. So it's going to be open hunting season on that particular day that was decided by the casting of lots. Now, the Persian word for lot is pur, P-U-R. The Jews made a commemorative feast to honor what is going to happen in the book of Esther. And that feast is called the Feast of Purim. They took the word pur, P-U-R, and added two other letters to it, and it was like our Independence Day, but it was a day of great, great rejoicing because instead of the Jews being destroyed in the 12th month, the whole situation flipped back the other way. And that's what the book of Esther is all about. We haven't given all the details of that. But Mordecai, when he hears of it, wants to make sure, well, the Bible says he walked through the city and he was crying, weeping, or perhaps shouting out, and he arrives outside the palace like he had been there, you know, before when he discovered the plot to kill the king. He's at the gate of the palace, but he's not allowed to go into the palace because that's sacred ground, and he's in sackcloth, and he's wailing and crying out. And whenever the people who are outside, who are Queen Esther's friends, see what's going on, they say, "Your cousin is out there in sackcloth." So she sends him some better clothes to wear. She evidently, she may not understand exactly why he is weeping in that. But Mordecai does not say to Esther, and I don't know how many times in preaching I've said, and we need to remember what Mordecai said to Esther. He said it through an agency. One of the servants of the queen of the world, Esther, goes out and takes his garments and tells him to put them on. He said, "I'm not putting on these garments, but because every Jew on this earth is weeping." And so he sends word to Esther, and he says to Esther, "How do you know that you are not queen of the world so that you can save the Jewish nation?" Now he says it in these words, "Perhaps you've been brought to the kingdom for such a time as this." I love living my life with that in the back of my mind. 37 years ago, I moved to Palm Beach Lakes. Didn't overly want to move. Children in great Christian school and everything, but I was so frustrated with that church I was preaching at in Birmingham. Would not be evangelistic. Heavily evangelistic in world evangelism, but as far as trying to convert folks in Birmingham, they just thought, well, it's just a whole lot better for us to support. We were supporting 100 preachers in India, and we felt real good about it. And I did. I'm thankful for the work they were doing overseas. And they would have sent me anywhere in the world that I would have asked them to preach. But the church got to be evangelistic. And came down here and met with this eldership. And two of the men that are elders now were part of that hiring of me. And so if you want to get mad at them, get mad at Joe Holland and get mad at Johnny Davis. They hired me. But when I met with them and they said, "Here's our visitors from last Sunday, and whatever you ask us to do to help this church become evangelistic, we'll do." And I had never, since that, It was like talking to other missionaries in New Zealand about the importance of being evangelistic and everything, and to meet an eldership that says, this is the way we want to be. And, perhaps I'm here for that reason. I don't know that that's that. But doesn't that make it life exciting? Have you ever thought about the fact perhaps you're here this night to hear this very sermon? I want you to think about that. Sometimes I'll preach a sermon and the very people that I thought it would help don't even show up. And somebody will walk out and said, you'll never know how much that sermon helped me. And see, it's no glory to me. I want you to understand, I don't take that as glory to me. God is trying to help that person. And here is the circumstances that happen in their lives. And sometimes people have great adversity. And they look back at it in hindsight. And thing that ever happened to me. There was a rugby player in New Zealand. He was a Maori, one of the Polynesians there. They had the national rugby team. And at 18, 19 years of age, he was the star of the rugby team throughout New Zealand. Now, fifth quarter parties after rugby are wine, women, and song, okay? And so he had his life laid out before him, being a sports hero, and people knew him. And all of a sudden, at 19 years of age, has his leg amputated. Where's your future? He started studying the Bible. And John Gerard was a person that when I'd start quoting a verse, he'd start quoting it back to me. When Billy Graham came to New Zealand, John Gerard went and had a discussion with Billy Graham about why don't you preach what the Bible preaches about Acts 2:38. Do I know that happened for that? No, I don't know that that happened. But if you look back in your life and see things that happen in your life, and it just, perhaps you're living right next door to some people. Perhaps the people that are moving in next door to you, due to being in the hospital. Perhaps every nurse that I've met coming in, that I've tried to give invitations to about coming to Palm Beach Lakes, perhaps for that very reason, physical therapist came today, and she was a bubbly kind of person and everything, and I said, you must go to church somewhere, anybody that's as happy as you are, and she said, I haven't found a church yet. Perhaps, I don't know, that just makes life exciting. Some house going to burn down tomorrow, Chuck. And you're going to be over there. Well, you hope not, okay? And there's that family, and they're in grief and everything. Perhaps. And it makes life exciting to live life understanding. And you never know. You believe God's working in this on this earth? Yeah, that's what He said He'd do. He'd work all things together for our good. And some of the troublesome times in my life, I can look back and think, I'm sort of glad that happened. Perhaps. And did God make it? I don't need to know. That's what Mordecai is saying. Perhaps. Perhaps. Taylor, perhaps this lesson that you gave to us tonight came about because of who you married, and she taught you all that you gave to us tonight. You understand what I'm talking about? I don't mean to get to that level of saying that everything that happens in your life, God makes it happen. That's not what I'm talking about. But I am talking about if you want to make life exciting, perhaps. Johnny, you're on that advisory board at Fried Hardeman. Why? I don't know. Perhaps. Doesn't that make going to that meeting a little bit more exciting, and that type of thing? And if you can develop that in your life, and so perhaps you're brought to the kingdom for such a time as this. Oh, by the way, Esther, you're about to die. Whether you think you're living there as the queen of the world, I want you to understand that you're going to suffer just like every other Jew just a few months from now. And perhaps right in the middle of the most troublesome time of your life, in which your entire nation is going to be wiped out. Perhaps. Is that exciting? And I want you to think about that. Perhaps a person will walk into this building Sunday. Perhaps that person sits beside you. Perhaps. Does that make life exciting? And I look back in my life, I don't know. I don't know why I went to New Zealand. I mean, yeah, I do. I wanted to be a missionary somewhere, and almost went to Argentina. Very, very, very close to going to Argentina. All of a sudden, a door opens up to go to New Zealand, and I think I'd have fallen flat on my face in Argentina. I think I'd have been an absolute miserable failure had I gone to Argentina. I cannot learn another language. But to go to New Zealand and the things that transpired in relationship to that, perhaps. And I want you to develop that in your mind in relationship to who you're going to meet tomorrow. And everybody you meet. Now he says to Mordecai, now, if you don't do your job, that's not going to frustrate God one iota. Before you get all puffed up about who you are and the doors that are before you, you know, if you hadn't have done it, God would have found some other way, some other person to do that. And that ought to help you to avoid Haman's problem, and that is falling in love with yourself and to see the blessings that can come from adversity. It changes every one of us. And so he says, perhaps. Now then, that's last week's lesson, but that's the background. I want to show you something rather interesting from the book of Esther. And it's in the last verses. What is that? Is that chapter 4? It's in the last verses of chapter 4 whenever Esther responds to what Mordecai says. And I won't find it in the book of Ezra, will I? In Esther chapter 4, Esther told them to go tell Mordecai. That's in verse 15. Go gather all the Jews who are present in Shushan, that's the capital city where the palace is, and fast for me, neither eat nor drink for 3 days, night and day. My maids and I will fast likewise, and so I will go to the king, which is against the law, and if I perish, I perish. What a great understanding about life. There are things worse than dying. If I die, I die. And so, acting on the advice that he's given, so Mordecai went his way and did according to all that Esther commanded them. What did she command them? You go and do what? Fast for how long? 3 days and three nights. But look at the... Ignore chapter divisions. Ignore chapter division because it says, and it happened on the third day. That's interesting, isn't it? In relationship to the resurrection of Jesus, there are three ways the Hebrews express time. And they're the same. We struggle sometimes with the Lord being 3 days and three nights in the tomb. When was He crucified? How can that be three nights? If He was crucified on Friday, and that's Friday night, Saturday night, and yes, He's supposed to be three nights in the grave. People struggle with that. And it's all right with me if Jesus was crucified on Thursday. I'm a whole lot more concerned about the resurrection day. I'm a whole lot more concerned about the resurrection day. But we read that and it gives us all kinds of problems. Why? Because we're taking Western, the Western world way of describing times, and we're using the words in the very way you and I use it. There are two other expressions that are used to describe the resurrection. One is, he'll be raised on the third day. And the other expression is, after 3 days. And that just bothers us so much. How can it be on the third day and be after 3 days and be 3 days and three nights? Well, what we have failed to understand is that the way time is expressed in other cultures may not be the same way time is expressed in our culture. I grew up in Alabama, and this has very little to do with time. It has to do with the interstate. When they said on the interstate, and you're coming up on the exit, and it says the next exit, is that only Alabama trouble that couldn't decide, is it this exit or the next one after this one? And I'm telling you, I had problems with that, you know. Come next Sunday. Well, when's that? You know, if somebody says on Friday, well, come next Sunday. Is that this Sunday or is that next Sunday? And so on the exit, I grew up couldn't figure out, am I supposed to get off at this exit or the next exit? And I have finally figured out that when it says next exit, it means this exit, you know. But that's a cultural thing. And you've got the same thing a lot of times whenever you're from a different culture. Johnny, did you have that problem? You probably, with that engineering mind, never had that problem at all. There's only one exit in Fayette. That's the only reason he didn't have that problem. Anyway, but you stop and think about the Jews use that expression to refer to the exact same period of time. Here's another illustration of it. You fast 3 days and three nights, and I'll go before the king, and she goes on the third day. Well, if you fasted 3 days and three nights, you're going to go on the fourth day. She didn't go on the fourth day. She went on the third day. So on the third day, she's going before the king. There's only one problem. You cannot walk into the presence of the king. You cannot walk in the presence of the king uninvited. You will be put to death. Anybody, even the queen of the world, would be put to death if she walks into the king's palace. You're talking about a strong, powerful dictator of the world. So what does she do? Well, you read the beginning part of chapter 5, and the beginning part of chapter 5 says, it happened on the third day that Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace, not in the palace, just in the courtyard. The courtyard, evidently, that's the inner courtyard, the part that's closer to the king, across from the king's house, while the king sat on the royal throne in the royal house facing the entrance of the house. And when he saw Queen Esther standing in the courtyard, she found favor in his sight, and the king held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand. And Esther went near and touched the top of the scepter, and the king says, "What do you wish, Queen Esther? What do you wish? What is your request? I will give to you up to half of the kingdom." She's been a pretty good queen. She has obtained the favor of the king. And he is so much in love with her that he says, "I will give you half of the kingdom." What is half of 127 provinces? You want to look at a map? "I will give you half of the kingdom." Now, when we read last week, all the way from Ethiopia, Persia is way, way over, almost into Saudi Arabia. And so from Saudi Arabia, you got to go through Iraq and Iran, just north of there. You got to go through, go up around Nineveh, Tigris and Euphrates up there, come down to Syria, come down to Palestine, come down to that part of the Sinai, get down to the land of Egypt, and go several hundred miles down the Nile River You know, that's how big the provinces were. He ruled the world. And he says, I'll give you half of them. It's amazing what she requests. The Bible says, she says, if it pleases the king, let the king and Haman come today to the banquet that I have prepared for him. We talked about this last week. The Jews celebrate the Feast of Purim, and a part of that they read this verse. And we were in the synagogue during this time, at least in most synagogues. Anytime you say Haman's name, everybody in the synagogue hisses and boos. And so, just invite King. You come and let Haman come. Well, the king says, bring Haman quickly, that he may do as Esther has said. So the king and Haman went to the banquet that Esther had prepared. At the banquet of wine, the king says to Esther, what do you want? It'll be granted to you. What is your request? Up to half of the kingdom. It shall be done. And Esther says, here's my petition, here's my request. If I found favor in the sight of the king, and if it pleases the king. Isn't this amazing? If it pleases the king, if it pleases the king. How she understands how to deal with this situation. Fulfill my request, then let the king and Haman come to the banquet which I will prepare for them, and tomorrow I will do as the king has said. I'll let you know tomorrow what the request is. Haman walked out of that day joyful and with a glad heart, but then he saw Mordecai. Ever have something get under your skin? How much happier could it be than to have just accomplished everything he wanted to accomplish? That is the killing of Mordecai and the Jews, because he'd given the kings 10,000 pieces of silver, and that was about, evidently, secular history indicates, it was up to 60% of the annual revenue that King Ahasuerus needed to run the kingdom. You know, there was some 14,000 pieces of silver, and he said, you don't have to worry about the taxes coming in this year, or you let those go ahead and do the, but I'll give you the gift of 10,000 pieces of silver if you'll give me the signet ring. And that's how this decree got sent out to all of the provinces. But Haman walks out, and when he walks out, there is Mordecai. And he did not stand or tremble before him. He was filled with indignation against Mordecai. Nevertheless, Haman restrained himself and went home, and he sent and called for his friends and his wife Zeresh. There's some unusual women that are in the forefront in this book. Think of Vashti with her self-respect and the virtuousness of her life and the decision that she made to rebel against the king. Whether she knew what the consequences would be, there's no way for us to know. But now he calls in all of his friends, and Haman told them of his great riches. Just interesting what's happened here. He calls him and he tells him all of the money that he has, the multitude of his children, everything in which the king had promoted him, and how he had advanced him above all officials and servants of the king. Number one man in the entire kingdom, right below the king. And then he says, moreover, besides, Queen Esther has invited no one else but me to that banquet that she's preparing tomorrow, and I am again having been invited for her along with the king. The queen of the world has invited two people to a banquet tomorrow. Obviously the king, but of every other resident in the entire world, I am the only one invited. I am the greatest. You know, I'm number one. I am number one. Then he says, yet all of this avails me nothing so long as I see Mordecai, the Jew sitting at the king's palace. It's meaningless. Isn't that amazing? How the things you think that would bring you the greatest joy don't bring you any joy at all. Isn't that amazing? How the things that you think would bring you the greatest joy do not bring you joy. Moses chose to suffer with the children of Israel than to enjoy the treasures, the pleasures of Egypt. He turned his back on all of the riches of the things that were there in the land of Egypt, and so he turned his back on that. What are we going to do about this? Well, could I tell you that they advise him, you want to solve this one? Build a gallows. We're going to hang Mordecai on it. You see how big the gallows is? How tall is that gallows? How much is 50 cubits in real money? You see this peak right here? Is that 30 feet? I think it's, Johnny, anybody remember how long, David, you've been on the ladders here. Is that 30 feet? I don't know if it's 30, maybe it's 25, I don't know. How many people could you stand on top of my head, before we reach the height up there? 75 feet. Was there a movie called Hang 'em High or something like that, or something like that? Hang 'em High. Tomorrow, I'm going to win. I have gotten rid of the Jews, and I've gotten rid of Mordecai. In the morning, first thing I'm going to do is to go and ask one more favor of the king, and that is hang 'em high. That's it for tonight. Thank you very much.